Today's lecture is lecture 13. It's on figures, tables, maths, and algorithms. And your heart sort of sinks when you hear that this is what the lecture's about, because this is 2.5 chapters of the textbook. And what can you say about this in a lecture? So first of all, I would say, read the textbook. There's lots of information, but in particular, when you come to write a paper that's going to need figures, tables, algorithms, or mathematics, once you've written the first draft of the paper, go back and read this and see how many mistakes you made, because the only way you learn is by doing it. So, as we've said several times before, the main point of these things is to maximize the information flow from your head, from your brain, to the brain of your reader. And we looked in the last lecture about playing around with a bunch of graphs. And I mentioned that on the website there's a handout from a completely different course, a course by a guy called Steve Simon, who's got guidelines for good graphics. So this provides a counterbalance to Justin Zobel's view, and I'd like to emphasize that both Zobel and Simon are giving guidelines for what they think is the right thing to do. And they are guidelines. They're not rules, they're guidelines. So if you religiously follow the rules they have set down, you will get it wrong. Because the whole point of these things is to maximize the information flow. So you've got to get things right. So, mathematics. What is the purpose of using mathematics? Well, it's to convey the information from your brain to your reader's brain as efficiently as possible. And the great thing about math is it's precise. It's really precise. Unfortunately, that means it's also really hard to read. So I don't know how many of you have struggled with understanding maths, where 3 or 4 lines of maths take you half an hour to understand, whereas pages of English are very easy to understand but are not precise. So maths gives you clarity and precision, which is nice. So let's now look at what goes wrong. And what can go wrong and what does go wrong in scientific papers is you often are having to invent notation, and you end up using too complex a notation. So for example, you see those first 3 letters where it says odd symbols? Does anybody know what those first 3 Greek letters are? If you use those first 2s, what you'll get is some of your readers know the Greek alphabet and they will read it and they'll say psi equals zeta times this. Other readers will go squiggly letter equals other squiggly letter. Are they the same squiggly letter? And you've got to watch out for that, because if your person's used to reading things like a plus b equals c or alpha plus beta equals gamma, if you give them psi plus zeta equals theta, they might know theta, but having them mentally saying squiggly letter isn't going to work. Now, the next one, number 4, who knows what that is?
Aleph.
Yeah, it's Aleph. Georg Cantor used the Hebrew alphabet in some of his work on transfinite numbers, and Aleph is the only one that survived. He used the Hebrew alphabet apparently because he'd run out of Greek and Roman letters. Does anybody read enough Hebrew to tell me what the last 4 letters say? It's Rivka. It's the Hebrew Rebecca. So, but if you are not a reader of Hebrew, then that's completely incomprehensible. It's just strange shape. Now, the next one, poor choice of symbols. You really need to choose the symbols that everybody uses. So everybody uses X, Y, Z to represent 3-dimensional coordinates. If you choose V, Y, W, people are going to be confused. We use I and J for indexing, and so on. I've seen people do superscripts where they really do things like this, where you have a couple of superscripts, a couple of subscripts. And if your notation is getting this complex, you want to rethink your notation. But if you're doing research, you may find that you're inventing notation as you go. And then the other things that go wrong is people don't explain what's going on. They expect the mathematics to explain what's going on. So I said mathematics is really quite hard. It's very dense, very concise, very precise, and sometimes some English fluffiness around it saying, we're now going to show this, this, and this, and then get into the proof. So at least your reader knows what the maths is supposed to be doing. So I have a couple of examples. I have one example of some notation we struggled with for ages. So at the top here, you can see there's a diagram. It's a diagram of how p's at level lambda minus 2 are combined together to make p's at level lambda. So there's a superscript telling you what level you're at. Don't worry about why you go from lambda minus 2 to lambda. And this diagram is such a nasty piece of math that this diagram is actually explaining some equations down here. I will show you how to make a pi lambda from some other things. And there are four possible cases, as you saw in the diagram, or maybe you didn't see in the diagram. There are four cases, A, B, C, D. And the interesting thing about this is P is a point. Good. P for point. Standard notation for a point is to use a P. I is an index. We're used to I, J, K being indices, so that's good. So that immediately the reader's got some grasp of this. In this particular notation, T is used for a very specific thing. Everybody uses the letter T. And we had some special cases of these T's. What letter should we use for those? We actually started off using tor, the Greek tor. It got quite painful. So we decided we'll use U, because everybody will remember that the letter after T is U. And then you'll see the subscripts here are alpha, beta, gamma, delta, the first four letters of the Greek alphabet. So it wasn't easy coming up with this notation. We went through several iterations, but we ended up saying, well, it's complicated, it's going to be hard, so let's refer always back to what people know. So we know what I is, we know what P is, we know what T is. We have to introduce U, okay. We need some subscripts. If we use A, B, C, D, that's going to be confusing. We'll use alpha, beta, gamma, delta, because we haven't used Greek letters anywhere else. So you have Roman letters subscripted with the Greek letter. It wasn't easy, but we ended up here. I'm not sure we have optimized, but at least gives something that people have a chance of understanding. So things can go wrong. The book talks about all sorts of other things you should do if you're doing maths. So what about tables? So what are tables for? Well, tables in your paper are to help maximize the information flow from you to your reader. We've said that before. And they're to present little bits of numerical data in a nice compact form. So what goes wrong with tables? Well, people tend to go overboard. The standard tools for producing tables allow you to have lots of chart junk, lots of unnecessary ink that you don't need. And the other two things that go wrong, too many significant digits and poor alignment of columns. So let me, again, the advantage of a lecture is I can run through an example with you. This example is also on the website. So here is a table. So what we're showing is a file name, imaginatively called image1.jpg, image2, and image3. The time taken to compress it, the final file size, and the compression ratio. And this is the standard table you will get if you produce a table in Microsoft Word. Of course, most of you will probably use LaTeX, but you still are going to face a lot of the problems that I tell you about. So first of all, this table does not need to look like a spreadsheet. It does not need to have all of these boundaries around it. And in fact, tables tend to look cleaner if you start like this. It's now, we've removed all that unnecessary ink, and you can still see, amazingly, that these things are lined up in columns and in rows. You didn't need all of those bars. You don't need all those bars in order to be able to see that these things are lined up. You can actually see, because you're actually quite clever. So that's one thing that was wrong. We might decide that actually to look pretty, so now we're talking about aesthetic judgments, it might be nice to say, let's make it obvious that there's a header line. Let's make it obvious where the table ends so that it doesn't run into some following text. We might even say something like, let's make the heading bold. Very subtle there. All of this is cosmetic, but it does help it to be easier to read. Now, the table is so that people can do comparisons of these numbers, and these numbers are way too precise. The time is 145.678943 milliseconds. That's accurate to a nanosecond. So actually, maybe if people are comparing, actually let's get rid of all of those extra digits. Now it's accurate to the nearest millisecond. I actually didn't even bother to round it off, sorry. But now if somebody's comparing it, a human being looking at that will say 145, 254, 31, I can immediately see which one's bigger. And in fact, why do we say milliseconds each time? Let's put the units up in the header and delete them here. And now all of a sudden, you can compare those, except for one small subtlety, which is the bottom line Though you can see it's 31, your brain says the 3 is lined up with the hundreds and the 1s is lined up with the 10s. But we can quite happily bang that over there. And now it's lined up nicely the way you'd expect as you'd write it in primary school. The units are lined up and the 10s are lined up. And you can immediately see that image 3 is much quicker than the other two just by looking at the length of the digit. A file size here, same problem. Way too precise, and in fact so precise here that I think 3 significant digits would be enough. So 17,300. This one will go to 29200, and this guy will go to 3620. So same problem again, and we can right align that, and this is starting to get tedious. And now there's an interesting thing. Kilobytes is the number that just came out of the system. Maybe it would be just much more efficient to measure this in megabytes and put the decimal points in, which allows us to get rid of these gratuitous extra zeros. And maybe we don't need to say 3.68 because now the units are not aligned anymore and the decimal points are not aligned. We really should align on the decimal point. So one way to do it is to simply say we'll just use 2 significant figures for that one. And, well, compression ratios are just bad. Let's just get them down to 2 significant digits because all we're doing is comparing these things. So now you've got information nicely presented, very easy for the person to quickly do a quick comparison and look at these things, and you haven't really lost any information. The information is all in the most significant digits. Because the problem now is it really is an awful long way from the name of the file across to the numbers because this is using the whole width of the page. I want to make them thinner. Autofit. Did you in the middle? Autofit. Oh. And you might say, well, you know, we could, in fact, even make it more efficient by making headings. Whoops. That look like this. So now I really am just fiddling. But now you have a nice, neat little graph with the numbers, very clear, very quick to assimilate. So we're trying to get fastest communication from our head to the reader's head. So one of the problems we see in lots of papers is people put in far too many significant digits and you can't compare. Or they don't line things up. So you mix up something in kilobytes with something in megabytes and it just doesn't communicate the information. So always remember what the main point is, which is to communicate information from your head to your reader's head. Now, as computer scientists, there's an entire chapter on algorithms. Algorithms are bread and butter for us, and presenting algorithms in paper is really quite a complicated business, as you'll have read in the chapter on algorithms. And there are all sorts of problems here. Often, an algorithm written in pseudocode is actually less clear than writing out the steps in prose. Often it's just a lazy way to write. And these days, algorithms are so complicated, you might want to have an appendix that is, in fact, the actual code somewhere on a website. And one of the problems is that notation can be confusing. And if you use either code fragments in a particular language or pseudocode, you're making all sorts of assumptions about the semantics and the syntax, and that a reader understands things in the same way you do. And as this is about getting ideas from your head to their head, you do really need to ensure that you don't fall into these problems of explaining things in a way that the reader doesn't understand. Having said that, we did in fact try this in one of our papers, and we came up with an algorithm because we couldn't work out any other way to explain this. And this is a sort of pseudocode explanation of our algorithm. We got some very carefully defined inputs and outputs, and we leave it to you to work out how to do the union of two vectors, and we check things and do loops. And you can see here, we're doing those sorts of things shown in the previous diagrams. And I am still ambivalent about whether this was the correct way to present it in the paper. But the PhD student authoring this found that he couldn't explain it in prose. This was the clearest way to explain it, and then have a prose explanation that refers back to this piece of pseudocode. So that's algorithms. You can read more in the textbook. And then figures. I'm a graphics person, so I put lots of figures in my papers. And again, what's the purpose of figures? It's to maximize information flow. So the last 10 minutes of this lecture, we'll be looking at some papers I've written and commenting on what the figures were for, whether they really achieved what they did, what we were trying to do, because that should help you with your work. Let's start with this paper, comparison of relative mouse-like and absolute tablet-like interaction with a large stereoscopic workspace, which didn't quite win the prize for longest title in that year's conference. This is a paper that Mellinot and I worked on together, and it's about interacting with stereoscopic displays in different ways. So you can see there's lots of text. It's a paper, of course. So the first figure you get is a picture of the experimental kit we used. So we were working with a big 3D display. It's a big three-dimensional screen. And we were tracking this hat, as it happens, and this pointer using the Vicon system. Now, we got pictures of all of this kit in the paper. It's a little gratuitous, but it does help the reader to understand exactly what sort of kit we were working with when we did this experiment. So they can then make a judgment of how accurate that will be. We also have a photograph of Mellinos working with the system. So you can see two of the detectors are there either side of the screen, and he's manipulating the pointer, and it's moving our virtual pointer in the 3D space, and he's designing tables and chairs in this case. And on the left-hand side, you see the more abstract positioning task that we used. And we really need a picture of that because people need to know what are we trying to do, what does it look like, and from that, make a judgment of whether our experiment had any validity. So again, lots of text. What other things can we do? We had some tables, and we spent quite a lot of time arguing about exactly how these tables should be laid out. And you can see this is a standard statistical table, which you may have seen produced by R. And it was really hard to get these things to line up neatly. So you see in the SS column, we've lined up on the decimal point. In the MS column, we've managed to do that. And in the F column, there may be too many significant digits here. But then when you get to the p-values, you can't represent this as 0.160118. You actually have to resort to scientific notation. Probably this p-value here should have also been done in scientific notation. And the important thing is that these numbers are over here. So it was quite difficult to work out. We probably spent more time tuning these two tables than writing quite a lot of the text. More tables. Then we were graphing things, trying to show how much time our users had spent completing the task of putting pegs into holes using the pointer to do so. And we have four different tasks, and we've used these bar and whisker diagrams to consolidate the data from our many trials. And you see that what these show is they show the minimum and the maximum at the ends of the whiskers, then the lower quartile and the upper quartile at the end of the box, then the thick bar in the middle is the median. So you can see that these two, the first and the third trial, most people are actually doing this really fast, but there's at least one person in each case who's quite slow relatively. Whereas in the second and the fourth case, you can see visually that it looks as if these are slower than 1 and 3. So visually, this presents the data to people saying, it looks like 1 and 3 are faster than 2 and 4. We still had to do all the statistics to prove that, but this allows people to look at the data in a consolidated way. Over here in accuracy, it turns out none of the methods is any different to any other method. And we got statistical results for that, but the graphs allow you to quickly see that the data appears to back that up. We also did some scatter plots. This is the time you spent to do things along the horizontal axis via the accuracy you got on the vertical axis. And you can see that these trend lines that have been added in, the very thin lines, are almost horizontal, which means there's really not much of a trend in there. But what this is all the data plotted now, so that people can really look at it. And what you see is the interesting thing is that these are all clustered down here, and these are scattered all over the place, but that it is the people who took a really long time who were the most accurate. The people who were very fast tended to get it more wrong. So it's a way of displaying all the data to help people. Oh, then there's these gratuitous bar charts, which in retrospect, these don't tell you much. You could have had a little table that told you that, but they're pretty. So they don't add much to the paper at all. So there's actually an online critique of this paper that I wrote, which has two pages explaining what went right and what went wrong about each of these things we chose to do. So we did our best with this paper. We thought we produced a pretty attractive paper that presented things right. And now when I go back and critique it a couple of years later, I think, you know, we could have done that better. We could have presented these as tables. We could have done things differently. We could have made those tables better. Then if I go back to finish off, if I go back 15 years, this is something I produced 15 years ago. This is a paper about an autostereoscopic camera system. So you see this rather funky little perspective picture, which must have taken me a day to draw. Shows you there's a bunch of cameras. They feed into a box, which feeds into an autostereoscopic 3D display. And our viewer here is looking at a three-dimensional picture from the 3D camera. And we could have just described this. But we felt having this picture helped people to immediately grab what we were talking about. We did have more serious scientific diagrams. So over here, with a diagram trying to explain the difference between having all your cameras pointing in at a point and having all your cameras parallel, which is a very subtle point. And trying to explain this in prose was difficult. The picture helped enormously in getting readers to understand what we were talking about. And then more real, proper systems stuff. Over here, we've got a block diagram of the system. Cameras, they go into camera boards. There's a backplane. Our multiplexer feeds the display. Very simple block diagram, but that helps you understand what's going on. So it's all about helping people to understand what's going on. And then I think of greater interest to you systems people in the audience is this. This is the multiplexer board. And it's a block diagram showing the specific functional blocks in the system where data is coming across some sort of backplane into a digital analog converter producing the video. There's some other blocks. And I'm quite proud of this in that it's pretty clear what the flows are. There are arrows. It's clear which things are flowing to what. It shows you all of the bits of the system. And one real subtlety here is the control lines are in gray. And the data lines are in black. And unfortunately, it's actually really hard to see that. So we should really have used dotted lines for the control signals rather than solid gray lines. So the point of all this visual stuff is to get the ideas from your head to your reader's head, whether it's a figure, a graph, a table, an algorithm, or some beautiful mathematics. So always remember, there are no rules to how to do this properly. There are only guidelines. If you follow the guidelines, you're likely to get it right. But always you have to add your own judgment to how to best communicate the ideas. And always get somebody else to proofread it and make sure they understand it, because what's clear to you may be completely opaque to everybody else in the universe. Thank you.